Welcome, welcome. This is another part of long COVID and chronic fatigue. We are really working on presenting to you all how long COVID happens and also what you can do about it and its relationship and similarity to chronic fatigue. Today, I have a chance to interview Dr. Gary Kaplan, and Gary has done some really a lot of great work, and especially in helping bring clinical research alive. And that's a topic that's dear to my heart, and we won't talk too much about it today, but I just want to thank him, because that is a very difficult thing for people who are practicing medicine, to also work with researchers and help really answer the questions that you as patients need answered. And along that way, he's also published a book recently called Why You Are Still Sick, which is, I think, a great book to look for and get some help. The subtitle, I think, says it all: how infections can break your immune system and how you can recover. So we're gonna be doing a little deep dive in some of the underlying risk factors and triggers for winding up with long COVID and or chronic fatigue, and talking a little bit about how Dr. Kaplan, Gary, as we'll call him for today, has been working with treating a long COVID. So with that in mind, Dr. Kaplan, welcome. And tell me how you think about the underlying risk factors.
Eric, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for inviting me. It was good seeing you at the ILADS meeting not too long ago. And the topic here is extremely important and unfortunately a bit complicated. But there's a lot we have to talk about, so I'm anxious to go over this with you. I think just to kind of set up the stage, we have to think of a couple of things. You know, lots of people get illnesses, they get better, and they recover, and that's the end of it. If we look at things like post-treatment Lyme syndrome, for instance, post-treatment Lyme syndrome, 80% of people who get the infection recover with treatment, and 20% don't. And it becomes a real challenge as to what's going on with those people. And as we've worked with a lot of these different people, one of the things we find is clearly there's some form of genetics. There's a setup there. We don't understand that genetics yet. We're coming along, and there's a lot of research going on it, but we will find that there is a genetic susceptibility. And certainly, if you talk to people, you find out that it's not just, many people bring their kids to me, but it's not just their kid. It's mom also has been sick for a number of years. The brother, the sister has also been sick. And so you start finding these familial patterns where you see chronic illness becoming a thing within the family. It's not a psychological issue, but rather it's an issue of genetics. The other thing that we have to pay attention to is this concept of epigenetics. Epigenetics meaning on top of the genes, so things that turn on and off the genes. Because we have lots of genes, many of them don't actually ever get turned on. Some get turned on over time, so celiac disease. About 35% of the population has celiac disease. This is gluten intolerance. And have the genetics susceptibility to celiac disease, but only 3% of those people will ever actually come down with the disease. So something has happened to them over a series of time that has tripped off the genes that now make them have an autoimmune disease to gluten. And indeed, we used to think that the diagnosis of celiac disease was in childhood because it was a genetic problem. And the fact of the matter is, the majority age of diagnosis of celiac disease now is between 40 and 60. So our whole thinking about what's happening with these conditions is changing. So epigenetic things are environmental things that have impacted us that set us up for a point at which an infection comes in, and then the immune system doesn't respond necessarily in the way we had hoped it would. Now, the way we hope it would is it'll turn on, it'll do its thing, it'll turn off, it'll go back to monitoring things, and life is good. What happens in these people with chronic illness, and we're going to be focused specifically on ME/CSF and long-haul COVID, but the reality of the matter is we're seeing this in the post-treatment Lyme syndrome. We certainly see it in the PANS, PANDAS kids. We certainly see it I believe in chronic pain patients is a high percentage of them. We see it in complex regional pain syndrome. There's a whole array of illnesses, fibromyalgia, which we have previously diagnosed as kind of separate diseases. And because we describe their symptoms and believe we have called a disease, we need to be talking about the pathophysiology, the underlying cause of this. And I believe linking all of these, inclusive of long-term neuropsychiatric problems, chronic depression, obsessive compulsive disorders, bipolar disease, these are all neuroinflammatory diseases. All of these across the board, brains are inflamed. And so now the question is, how did the brain get inflamed? What's perpetuating it? And how do we back it out? So that changes our whole perspective in terms of how we're evaluating these people and then how we're going about treating them. And we're looking at it more as peeling layers of an onion, as opposed to you have strep, here's your penicillin, you got better, go away.
Right, right. This is just beautifully said. I really appreciate that nice overview, because inflammation, chronic inflammation, is the underlying risk factor for chronic disease. And then your genetics will determine what picture you display. You know, are you going to be the chronic fatigue person? Are you going to be the rheumatoid arthritis person? You know, but it's that chronic inflammation that's there. So how do you how do you go looking at the immune system? How do you break it down? How are you taking that picture apart?
Well, so when we talk about inflammation, the question is, what is inflammation? Okay. So an inflammation is a lot of different things in the body. So we need to be fairly specific when we're talking about it. So if you've got a runny nose and itchy eyes and you have symptoms of hay fever, all right, that's inflammation. The eyes are swollen, the nasal passages are swollen. The cause of that inflammation is an antigen reaction, antibody reaction, antigen reaction to to pollen. You might want to give an antihistamine.
Yeah, and just to clarify for people, because we're going to use a lot of terms, antigen means a foreign protein, and it can be anything. Okay, but and the antibody is what your B cells make to try to lock up that antigen and identify it.
And always stop me if I'm not speaking English. So what happens is now you've got an inflammatory response, but the cause of that is histamine release by mast cells. And so you want to do something that'll stabilize those. So antihistamines is a good way to go about doing that. Alternatively, you can get shots that'll help your immune system recognize these pollens and say, I don't need to be worried about them, and begin to stop responding to them. So that would be one way to treat that inflammation. If you skin your knee and it gets pussy and swollen, well, what's going on at that point is not histamine, but what's going on at that point is an infection in the skin. And you might want to treat that with an antibiotic. And then that will allow it to clear and recover. When we talk about inflammation in the brain, we're really talking about the either happening on the innate or the acquired side of the immune system. So there's two great big divisions of the immune system. On the innate side of the immune system, these are kind of our first responders, okay? These are the guys that are rushing in to put out the fire, all right? There's been damage to cells in the brain from a concussion. There's been poisoning secondary to, I don't know, heavy metals or mycotoxins, any of a number of things that have started to do damage to brain cells. Stress can also be on this list, by the way. But anything that's caused damage to brain cells, so these guys rush out. Now, you want to think of them another way as kind of the demolition crew, because you're going to remodel your kitchen, okay? Bit of a touchy subject for me, because I'm 6 months in. Our kitchen is still not livable. But so what happens is you hire the contractor, the guys come in to do the demolition, 5 days, everything's torn out, and the repair crew doesn't come. So now you're left with a kitchen that's all torn up, and nothing going on. So the next thing, though, that happens sometimes is the innate immune system gets a little bit haywire, and it also goes, hey, you know what? That dining room, maybe we could do something with that also. And it starts tearing that up. And then the next thing that happens, it looks at the living room, and it starts tearing that up. Well, that's your brain. So now it's tearing up different pieces of your brain, because the innate immune system has become grossly overactive and is, if anything, traumatized at times. And we actually, you know, I'm speaking metaphorically, but the reality of the matter is we do see a PTSD develop in the innate immune system, where it gets hit over and over and over again by different infections. And then what happens is it's hyperreactive. And then it starts doing lots of damage that it should not be doing, collateral damage. We also see it where it can cross-react, meaning it got hit and started to respond to one set of damages, and then it anticipates damage occurring, so it starts reacting again. So the innate immune system, we want to look in the brain. We're looking essentially at three cells. We're looking at microglia, which are by far and away the things that mediate inflammation in the central nervous system the most. We want to look at mast cells, okay, which mediate inflammation both inside and outside the brain. And we want to look at astrocytes. We'll put astrocytes aside in a great big hurry because we actually don't understand enough about them. Astrocytes help make the blood-brain barrier. They help feed and nurture the neurons of the brain. But how they interact without question as part of the inflammatory process and feedback loops. But exactly how that occurs is not well understood. So we get to focus primarily on microglia and mast cells. So when we first start off and we're looking at, let's back up even more and say, okay, how do I know my brain's inflamed? Focus and concentration issues, fatigue. You may have trouble keeping your eyes focused and seeing things. They may get blurry. Headaches, chronic body pain, sleep disturbances. All of these things are signs or symptoms of a brain that's inflamed. Sensitivity to light and sound and odors. All of these things are indicative of a brain that's hyperreactive. Okay. So
I just want to emphasize for people the continuum of this. This is one of the problems with medicine, is that we don't distinguish between mild, we don't acknowledge how mild symptoms can still reflect the same pathophysiology of severe symptoms. So the neurologist will look at the patient and say, oh, you know, these symptoms are too mild. There's no inflammation here. Not understanding that inflammation is what causes the mild headache and the severe and the brain fog and the moment, you know, so it's just degrees and how quickly you can turn this on and off. So just
I'm just
mentioning that because it's so frustrating for our patients when they go to when they go to the specialist, they're often ignored because they haven't had a stroke. And so therefore, they're really not.
You're not seizing in front of them. So how serious it be?
Exactly. I'm sorry. So keep going. You're doing.
You're exactly correct. And this is the problem, because the patients that I see are very, very sick. And the bottom line is they have neither been seen, heard, nor respected by the profession. And many of them suffer PTSD because of the way they have been treated by our colleagues. They're not listening to them, and the docs don't know what to do with them. And mostly they tell them, oh, go see the psychiatrist. Oh, you're under stress. Here, take a sleeping pill. And we end up treating symptoms, and symptoms then start piling on top of one another. And the next thing you know, you have a disabled kid, or you have a disabled adult. And so you're absolutely correct. We want to catch this stuff early and pay attention to it early and not get to it later. We'll have to deal with it later when we do. But and the silver lining with COVID, if there be any such thing, is the fact of the matter is post-COVID syndrome, one of the predominant symptoms is fatigue. And all of a sudden, the medical profession turned around and said, oh, wait. You can have fatigue as a real symptom, even though the acute illness is gone. Huh, who knew that? Well, the 1 to 2 million people suffering with MACSF knew that and it's been ignored for a long time. You know, if I, just as an aside, I served on the advisory committee in Health and Human Services for 4 years on MACSF. And one of the truly shocking things I discovered on that committee was NIH was devoting $5 million a year to the study of ME-CSF. In perspective, we're talking 1 to 2 million people struggling with this disease, 25% of whom are bedridden and completely disabled with this disease. And NIH is spending $5 million on research, which is in the vernacular bupkis. If you have multiple sclerosis, NIH was spending $135 million a year for 750,000 people suffering with the disease. The numbers didn't add up.
Yeah.
Basically, MACSF was dismissed for years until finally the CDC, I think around 2018, said, oh yeah, it's a real disease, and the P2P that happened. Yeah. And so it got acknowledged at least as a real problem. The problem still remains is that we're looking at it as a unique disease as opposed to looking more at the pathophysiology. And the pathophysiology is inflammation in the brain. And so again, we step back to the innate immune system. Now, the reason I'm talking about that is because if we know the pieces of the immune system we're targeting, we can and the cells in particular, we can then say, okay, what is it that sets off, causes a microglia to become an inflammatory cell? Because microglia's main job is to kind of sit, monitor, and make sure no bad things are going on. And if bad things are happening, the microglia go to the area, they get rid of all the damaged cells, they call in the repair crew, and they leave. That's their job, on and off. Just make sure everything's clean up the streets, make sure everything's staying okay. But when they get overreactive, they spew out a whole series of chemicals and reactive nitrogen species, oxygen species. They start doing, they blow up cells, and they can be turned on either by cell damage. So in cell damage, things that are inside the neurons come out into the surrounding fluid, the microglia perceive those, and then they start to react and go to the area of damage. A concussion will certainly accomplish that. Alternatively, if you get an infection that comes into the area, such as Lyme disease, or such as a viral infection, herpes encephalitis or such, the microglia will immediately start to respond in order to, it becomes a macrophage, and it can actually not just blow up the invading virus or bacteria, but it'll actually engulf it and try and get rid of it. So the microglia are really versatile little guys, and it's important for us to understand them, because when you look at that, you go, okay, what is it that sets off a microglia? Concussions, obviously, brain doing physical damage to the brain, but so will stress, okay? Long-term stress in particular. And if we look at kids who grew up in very difficult environment, abuse, neglect, what we find is about 15% more vulnerable to developing autoimmune diseases later in life. They're about 25% more vulnerable to developing cardiovascular disease later in life. There's a whole series of diseases that they are more susceptible to because their entire inflammatory system has been set on edge. And it's doing damage to the endothelium of the blood vessels. It's doing damage to the brain. And so there's a lot of problems that these kids are set up for. Now, we can reverse that by addressing that trauma. But that trauma, we also want to make sure we don't mistake for, well, your problem is you're fatigued because of the PTSD. Maybe that may be part, that unquestionably may be an issue, but it also may be the setup for what happened when the infection came along, and the infection came along and then really kiboshed you and did damage to the immune system.
And what I want to emphasize, and what I think is really important, is that it's not the PTSD that causes the damage as much as you need the, whether it be genetic or characterological basis for those things to cause damage. Because, you know, we see this all the time, people who have obsessive compulsive disorders, and they'll go back and say, well, it was because this and this happened when I was a child. And I go, no, you have obsessive compulsive disorder because you have the genetics that when your brain gets inflamed, right, this is how you try to defend yourself. You know, this is self-defense, because, you know, we psychology, working on yourself to help change your behaviors is really important. But don't spend your life trying to figure out what caused it, because you wind up blaming people instead of realizing, you know, this is who I am and what I have to do next. So there's a place for understanding, but don't get caught there. I always worry about, because your point you're making is just so important, that it's the inflammation that is that is the match, you know, or is the fire. Yeah, that you know, but the tinder is your genetics and your environment. Okay, I'm sorry. This is always
no. You're absolutely correct, and it's an extremely important point, Eric, because we get into this thing where it's like, Well, you have PTSD, and we dismiss you at that point, as opposed to going, no, back up. And especially with kids who are having obsessive compulsive disorders, you got to back up altogether and go, okay, when did this start?
Right.
And and so when we take histories, kind of going back to birth. You were in excellent health until when? And the very first thing pretty much all my patients do is lie to me. I was in excellent health until I was 19 or 25 years old when I got this infection. And prior to that, I was 100%. Really? Great. Okay. And I start going through the history and they say, oh, you have migraines. When did the migraines start? Oh, I started migraines when I was 12. Okay. How often do you get the migraines? Oh, the migraines are 5, 6 times, 8 times, 10 times a year. That's been a problem. Okay, fine. Did you have a lot of strep infections as a kid? I had strep infections all the time as a kid. I had tubes in my ears. So you start now, you're getting this history of repetitive assaults on a system. And you're also getting a hint that you had a lot of strep infections. When did the OCD start? Right? If the OCD started when you were 8, maybe the problem is strep and you've got PANDAS. So we want to say, we want to pay attention to how, when you're getting sick, the timeline that things are happening and what the setup is to begin with. My intake histories are about 2 hours long, literally. I mean, it takes a long time to start to take this apart, to get understanding of what's going on. And by virtue of doing that, we end up with a much more complete answer.
Right. So I think I took you off. I apologize.
No.
So getting, but I mean, because you were talking about the innate immune system and its effect on the brain, which is, you know, really just so important for obviously long COVID.
Right. So we also want to be looking at whether or not you have exposure to toxins. We find a very high percentage of our patients can't process mold toxins and they have toxins build up in their body. We find the percentage of our patients have heavy metals that have done damage to the neuronal system, and mercury and lead being the leaders. Occasionally we'll see arsenic, and that's inevitably from groundwater. Mercury is coming from fish. Unfortunately, we've soiled the nest. And so if you're eating swordfish and tuna and trout, a lot of the top feeders, we've been finding it in salmon now on a regular basis. Sometimes the easy way to get rid of the lead is simply stop eating the fish, or the mercury rather.
Mercury.
Lead typically is coming from paint. And we saw an outbreak of lead poisoning in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, when they started fixing up these old mansions, which had, they were sandblasting them. And the next thing you knew, they were vaporizing all of the lead paint in the air, and the kids were ending up with lead toxicity. Lead is also, unfortunately, very prevalent in our water supplies in this country. We saw the, you know, the big fuss that got made in Michigan with Flint, Michigan. Huge, massive problem. Okay. But the reality of the matter is, there's a very high percentage of our water supply in this country which is contaminated with lead. Mm-hmm. And so you need to be looking at the water and testing for these kind of things. If you're drinking well water, arsenic is certainly a possibility. So those are the three big ones. Cadmium, if we run into it, is typically because people are smoking cigarettes, which they're trying to kill themselves anyway. So perhaps just another way of going about doing it. But so you've got to pay attention to that. We have seen one or two people, unfortunately, there was a series of joint replacements that broke down.
Oh, yeah.
And ended up with chromium poisoning. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole bear to take care of. So we want to be looking for, you know, what other things are potentially in the system that are creating problems. And so we're kind of going through the history and looking for that and testing for it as we go along. Go ahead.
No. So I'm just, so because these are, you know, our underlying stressors that you're laying out are really what we see. Because, you know, it's just like ME/CFS, I think with long COVID, we're seeing the same thing where people come in and often say, you know, I was healthy till.
Yeah.
And it's only when you do the detailed history for, you know, I'm not saying it's 100%, but for almost everybody, you'll go back and you'll find that there were the old infections, you know, the that put them down for a month, you know, when they were 18, or, you know, the dental work that hadn't been fixed, or, you know, some history, migraines especially, these hints that the immune system is not self-regulating. as well as it should. So, and you were going to, with the innate, how do you weave that together with the acquired immune function and how they dance together?
So the acquired immune system are the smart guys, okay? Supposedly they're the guys who learn how to fight a particular infection. That's why we give immunization. We give you an immunization, flu immunization, and we teach your immune system to go fight this bug if it shows up. But this bug, not six other bugs, this bug in particular. So the innate immune system targets very specific things and hopefully nothing else. There is unquestionably some washover, meaning that sometimes when we give immunizations for one thing, we'll see some protection that also occurs for a couple of other bugs, but it's not as strong as the one we specifically immunize for. But the problem comes in when you've got an infection that turns on the innate immune system, and the innate immune system becomes overreactive. And there's a couple of processes. The most common one is a thing called molecular mimicry. And so what happens is there are codes on the outside of a bug that the immune system, the B cells, are targeted to. And that code can look very similar to our own proteins in different tissues in our body, specifically the brain. So as it's going after that, it can get confused and say, you know what? Yeah, this is the bug we want to kill, but these tissues over here have a very similar look to them. We're going to kill that too. The next thing that's happening is now your brain is being inflamed. The very fancy name for that is autoimmune encephalopathy of infectious etiology. We have a process where your own immune system has now started to attack your brain because it got confused by an infection that started the process. That's a whole nother thing. Now, there is cross-communication between the innate and the acquired immune system. And one can regulate or upregulate the other. And so you have to be paying attention to both at the same time. And you need to, once the point that the acquired immune system is tripped off, we have a bigger problem. If it's just on the innate side, it's actually relatively easy to address. Once the acquired immune system is kicked in, we have a much tougher time, because we need a whole bunch of fancier tools in order to be able to address it. And we don't always have access to those because of limitations that the insurance companies impose on us.
So let's just jump a little bit and we'll come back to etiology, but how do you approach long COVID these days? What's your, your favorites?
So with long COVID, the first thing is, history, get your diagnosis and get clear that that's what you're treating. But if it's a relatively clean case, I really was healthy until I got COVID. And the next thing you know, I'm still futzing around with fatigue and brain fog and headaches. And I've got tinnitus ringing in my ears. There's a whole list of things that got gastrointestinal problems, whole list of things that we see in long COVID. And by the way, the new studies coming out are showing that upwards of 2/3 of people may have long COVID symptoms. We have now gotten to the point where we're defining long COVID as symptoms that persist past 3 months. What other infection do we have that we say, well, after 3 months, then we've decided you're better? We're seeing that a high percentage of people have symptoms that persist for 3 months, and perhaps as many as 50% persist for over 3 months. So long COVID officially starts 3 months after you've had the infection, if you're still having symptoms. And a huge number of people still have those symptoms, and a huge number of people are, and they're not necessarily debilitating, though certainly a percentage of them are, but most of them are neurologic symptoms. Some are cardiac. Those are two, far and away, the two biggest things that we see. So you can see inflammation in the heart muscle itself that persists, or you can see inflammation in the heart muscle that occurs after the infection is gone. So these symptoms may actually have originally gotten better and then show back up several weeks, just a couple of months after you had the original infection. Fatigue, everything we talked about before in terms of headaches and focus and concentration issues. But the high percentage of people have neurologic issues, and that's chronic fatigue. And so that's been the boon in terms of research for the NACSF population, but it's a freaking disaster for those who are struggling with it. Right. And in fact, I just talked to one of my best friends last night. He and I were in Alaska together. He and I both got COVID while we were in Alaska together several months ago. He's still having trouble with word finding. He's having trouble with short-term memory issues. This is a very bright, accomplished guy. And he said, you know, I've been covering it up, but until we talked the other day, he said, I didn't realize that this was long COVID. All right. He wasn't like
this. He was getting older.
Right.
He got right. older fast, though. It's a little aging acceleration. That's what inflammation is on some level, you know, as well. So when you see these things, I mean, because what always is good and bad about medicine is that, you know, when it comes to acute disease, we count on the fact that most people get better within 6 weeks, no matter what we do.
Right. Okay. Right. Right. You're absolutely correct.
No, which is
very important. Otherwise, they'd have run us out of town ages ago.
Right. Right. That, luckily, you know, and with long COVID, it looks like in some of the numbers that by 6 months and a year, a lot of people do eventually get better, but we're still left with a fair number of people who are having persistent neurologic, you know, symptoms. And so where do you start as far as therapies? I mean, what's your favorite checklist, so to speak, of how you work down for the person with, let's say, you know, moderate fatigue, enough that it's interfering right. with life. They're not bedbound, but, you know, they can't go back to their full lives. They have to, like, they're working on the 4 to 6 hour day now instead of.
Right. So clearly some basic blood work. We want to check your blood count. We want to check your liver and kidney functions. We want to check your thyroid. We want to check whether or not there is another autoimmune process going on. So checking an anti-nuclear antigen. And we check SED rate and CRP. So just basic stuff, simple stuff. The other thing that we do is we do a cytokine panel. And so the cytokine panel was developed by Bruce. Hello.
Patterson.
Patterson. Thank you. Thank you. I was getting, maybe I've got one. No, I was getting stuck on another Bruce who worked in acupuncture. But Bruce Patterson. Developed the long haul COVID panel. We've been using that for well over a year now. And it gives us some insights as to specific inflammatory molecules, proteins, that are active, overreactive in the system. And if we see this kind of a pattern coming up, then we turn around and go, okay, we have specific medications that we use to treat this. So understand, none of this is approved by the FDA. Understand that this is all off-label, okay? So, but the medications that we'll frequently use is Selzentry, Ravaroc. We use aspirin, 81 milligrams can be helpful. We can use pravastatin, one of the statin medications, which actually helps reduce certain cytokines. And so we have very specific medications that we can use that have in fact been effective for us. They have proven to be effective for us. Big controlled studies? No, we don't have big controlled studies. We have a lot of clinical experience. We know that these are fairly safe medications to use. We're not seeing a lot of side effects with them. And more importantly, is we're seeing success with them. So that's one way to go about doing it. We have been using low-dose naltrexone. Low-dose naltrexone specifically targets the microglia in the central nervous system, that is the innate immune system. And indeed, a paper just came out the other day that said, oh, you know what? Low-dose naltrexone looks like it may be effective in treating long-haul COVID. So it's safe, it's simple. Now, what is low-dose naltrexone? So naltrexone is a medication that we use for treatment of drug overdose in high doses, maybe 50, 75 milligrams. Low dose, meaning somewhere between 1.25 and 4.25 milligrams, is what we use to quiet the activity of the microglia in order to sedate them a bit. And so using that in conjunction with some of these other medications, the Maraviroc was originally developed to help HIV patients, as that was original design. So we repurpose drugs, but we use off-label use of drugs is something we do all the time in medicine anyway. Nothing at all unusual about that. Elavil is used to treat migraines. Elavil is used, which is an antidepressant, is used to treat sleep disturbances. Elavil is used to treat irritable bowel syndrome. So off-use label of medications, repurposing of medications, isn't unusual in medicine.
It's actually necessary to, in order to practice medicine, because the cost to get a medicine approved for an indication is now easily in the $50 to several hundred million, depending on how hard you want to work at it. Even if it's not a new medicine, I mean, LDN, low dose naltrexone, is a very good example of, we started using, I think, in the late 90s for people with HIV and autoimmune, and then autoimmune diseases. And it's only in the last, I think, I don't know, maybe 5 to 7 years that the rheumatologists have stumbled upon it after we've been using it forever and being derided for it, I must say. and now somehow
we took our hits.
The medical community has like found it. And they're using it for, interstitial cystitis, because it does reduce inflammation. And like you say, when it reduces inflammation in the microglia, well, the brain does modulate the rest of the immune system. And I just want to bring that out for people who are concerned about off-label use of drugs. They have to understand that the on-label use of drugs would limit even a conventional doctor to doing what I call the simplest of band-aid medicine, which is, yes, you have some hypertensive and some anti-diabetics and a few pain medicines, and after that, everything else is off-label. Please understand that this isn't doing wild and wacky things, but getting back to your experience with Dr. Patterson's work, because we're going to have Dr. Patterson present how he developed his panel, and because I think it's not the end all and be all, but it is a piece of evidence that is giving us information. I think more information more than evidence to work with the immune system a little bit more specifically maybe than we've been able to in the past. Your experience, have you had you noticed that the Maraviroc, I guess, is the point that I is that most people are afraid of, because it was approved as an HIV drug. And there was originally a black box warning, which I think we can fairly say was an error. There was really no need for that. The subsequent, 15 years it's been in use, something like that now? Yeah, I don't.
Possibly more.
Yeah.
So our experience is we see, we do proper monitoring. We'll look at liver and kidney function and blood count to make sure nothing is going awry. We're in constant communication with our patients. But the reality of the matter is, knock on wood, so far we have seen next to no problems with the drug. Are there people who are occasionally intolerant to it? Absolutely, positively. There are people who are intolerant to penicillin. So you need to be doing this responsibly. But the reality of the matter is, we have seen both well tolerance of the medication and we've seen results from the medication. Now, caveat, Maraviroc is a strange drug, strange in the terms of the way the insurance company treats it. For some godforsaken reasons, Maraviroc cost our patients anywhere from nothing to $2,800 a month.
Oh, that's, yeah, I've always gotten it around 17 to 13, but you must have a really high priced.
somebody, this was the brand new high the other day when a patient who came in said it was going to cost them $2,800.
Wow.
So, we look at discount coupons. We do look as much as possible to be able to help our patients get access to the drug so that it's not costing them an arm and a leg, because they're going to need to be on the drug for several months. Yeah. It looks like probably about 3 to 6 months is normal treatment time for a very straightforward case of post-COVID syndrome. And so, and people will see impact from taking these medications within about within 6 weeks, but more commonly within 2 to 3 weeks, we see our patients starting to report that they feel better. Their energy is better. Their sleep is better. Less focus and concentration issues. So it works. It is effective. And so that's kind of our first line. Now we add some supplements to that also. So we want to do things that will help with detoxification of the brain. And so we'll use glutathione and we'll use N-acetylcysteine. N-acetylcysteine actually helps the brain make glutathione. And so we know that glutathione, and there's a couple of papers suggesting that the people who were dying because they had essentially glutathione deficiencies, and that if we gave them IV glutathione during the illness, they recovered. Small papers, small case studies, but nevertheless, the suggestion was there. It's a shame that the larger studies were not done. One of the things inhibiting the larger studies is how much money you're going to make if you prove the drug to be correct. Right. And the answer is next to nothing.
Yeah. We forget that they gave remdesivir, $800 million, $900 million just to start right. off to see what happens. Turned out yeah. to be maybe not a bad acute drug. It didn't do anything for really sick people. I'm sorry, my little soapbox. No, they tried to draw and quarter anybody who tried to use IV vitamin C or IV glutathione, which are right. cheap and can't hurt you. Almost.
Right.
I shouldn't say can't hurt you. Never should say can't hurt you. There's always some people you can hurt.
Right.
But right. 99.9, we don't hurt many. Anyway, right. that's...
And you're absolutely correct. And then some of the other things like low-dose melatonin, 1 to 3 milligrams, is a nice antioxidant in the central nervous system. Resveratrol can be a nice antioxidant. So these are things that help with the detoxification. I think the other thing that we want to pay really strict attention to is sleep. Sleep is really critical. Mm. And people think about, getting by on 5 hours sleep. That's a good way to set yourself up to get sick. Why? A couple of reasons. One is a great study just came out from Mount Sinai in the last couple of weeks, looking at the impact of sleep on the immune system. And having inadequate sleep actually is a setup for immune deficiencies, meaning immune dysregulation in terms of its response to things. So sleep is really important. The other thing that sleep does is it's the way the brain detoxifies. And so it's the way that it gets rid of metabolic waste products. And so literally your brain swells during the day because hopefully you're thinking, but as it acts, it's the most metabolically active organ in the body. When things are working, they produce waste products. And so what happens is at night, especially during slow wave sleep, stage 3-4 sleep, what happens is you actually get the recreation of these lymphatic-like channels called glymphatics that are the drainage ditches that allow all of this stuff to go away. So sleep is absolutely crucial in terms of helping us stay healthy and also recover when we do get sick, and specifically preservation in stage 3-4 sleep. Which brings up the point that if you're taking sleeping pills, they don't preserve stage 3-4 sleep. They just get you more sleep. But if you're not getting the right stages of sleep and quality of sleep, that's going to create a problem for you. So it's important that the architecture of sleep, stages 2, 3, 4, and REM, rapid eye movement sleep, are preserved in the ratios that they belong preserved in. Also, we need to pay attention. There's about 5% of the population who have sleep apnea. That's where people stop breathing at night. That makes the brain lose oxygen. Hypoxia is a lovely way to kill brain cells. And indeed, if you have sleep apnea and it's not treated, it's going to take about 10 years off your life. And how do you know if you have sleep apnea? You're falling asleep during the day. You're falling asleep after lunch. You're falling asleep during meetings. You're falling asleep sitting at stoplights at night.
That is the classic sign.
Yes. So you need to be, there's a thing called the Epworth scale, EPWRTH. It's a quick questionnaire that you can do online. And if you're scoring 9 or more above on that, you need to talk to your doctor and say, I did this, I found this, what do you think? And get them to pay attention to you. Because worst thing is if you've got sleep apnea, and 85% of people with sleep apnea are not yet diagnosed, if you take sleeping pills, your sleep apnea, meaning the lack of oxygen going to your brain, is going to get worse. So sleep is really crucial. The other thing I want to say that's really crucial in terms of keeping your brain healthy is your diet. And so we haven't talked about this. It's a great big topic all unto itself. But the reality of the matter is there is a direct relationship between the health of our gut and the health of our brain. And so that if we're not taking good care of our gut, we are not taking good care of our brain. The brain's inflamed, the gut's inflamed, the gut's inflamed, the brain's inflamed. So we need to be very careful. And so early on, when people come to me and they're sick, I put them on a, what's called a hypoallergenic diet: rice, fish, chicken, fresh fruits, and vegetables. I've eliminated soy, I've eliminated gluten, I've eliminated nuts and corn. I want to take as many potential allergens out of the diet so that I can get that quieted down. Now, frequently, we have to do more in order to help their guts. But the reality of the matter is we pay a lot of attention to gut health. We have a nutritionist as part of our staff in order to be able to help people recover. So there's lots of things you can do that aren't expensive, that are pretty straightforward, and are entirely in your hands. Meditation is a nice way to reduce inflammation in the central nervous system. So doing meditation on a regular basis is a really great thing to do. The other thing that becomes a little more problematic if your problem is fatigue is exercise. But exercise is hands down probably the single best anti-inflammatory in the body and the central nervous system, both aerobic and anaerobic exercise.
Yeah. And I just think that, again, to point out, you know, is that this is the yin and the yang, the push and pull nature of life, okay, is that you, in order to be strong, you have to exercise, but you have to rest. In order to relax, you have to have transient stress. Okay, if you just have relaxation, you have decay. It's just how the system works. Your immune system has to start and stop. If it just stops, you're going to die from the infection. And if it can't stop, you're going to die from your body's reaction to the infection. So
it's, well put.
It's just something that, because, you know, we grow up, I guess our brains are kind of set up for what I call, that linear engineer type thinking. You know, A right. causes B, and that's it. And what you're talking about, how important the gut is to the brain, is because they talk to each other. That back and forth right. communication with involving the vagus nerve, which we'll have some other talks on during this series, is just so important. So I love what you're doing. Basically, it's, you know, the treatment of long COVID is basically the treatment of chronic fatigue, with a little bit more specifics, because we were lucky enough that, for some reason, I guess it's because how many people got sick at once, that enough yes. that we're getting some really exciting research. It's coming up from chronic fatigue world, but it's the chronic fatigue research has been so slow to be, there's... Okay, I'm going on a rant, but just a very short rant here. There are so many great papers that have been written about chronic fatigue in the last, that have right. great ideas, but then there's never the money to do the next step and do something with them, okay? To take something that we did in 20 patients and then say, okay, now we're going to do it in 100, and then we're going to do it in 500 or 1,000, to actually prove to the medical world that this stuff works. And there's never the resources. So we keep spending resources on getting good ideas, learning little pieces, but never moving forward because of lack of resources. And I know that it's very hard for patients who are sick to understand, but it is, as you said in the beginning, when you're going to spend $5 million a year is enough to support maybe one researcher completely.
That's correct. That's correct.
It's not enough. I mean, but one thing I wanted to get to before we ended, I know, and this might be a little bit of a non sequitur at this point, but I would love to hear, you said you had some ideas on persistence, and I just want to put this out to our audience and understand one of the great questions, and maybe we'll have some more clear answers by the time we air, because we're recording this in October and we're airing in February. So is something that's bedeviled the chronic fatigue world and the research is there persistence of the trigger, or is it just immune memory, you know, that's happening? And, you know, and again, there's evidence, there's little bits of evidence. And then every time the evidence comes in that maybe it is persistence, people say, well, really, maybe it's just a piece of the bug that is being produced. Anyway, I'm going to shut up and let the good Dr. Kaplan tell me his story and his understanding of where we are today with persistence of some of these triggers.
So let me just do a quick plug. We, my foundation, Foundation for Total Recovery, and Georgetown University did a international conference in February of this year to talk about these kind of issues. And we're going to do another conference October 11, 12, 13 next year, in which one of the big topics is going to be on persisters, because it is such an important topic. And so what is a persister? Basically, it falls into one of two categories. That is, pieces of bug that are still around, that are annoying the nervous, the immune system and keeping it reactive, and replicable bug, that is living bugs that are still around, replicating in the system, perhaps hiding in different unique locations in the tissue, such as in the joint tissue, or hiding in biofilms, that are making it much harder for the immune system to get at. And this is a big challenging problem. In terms of post-COVID, Bruce's argument is that it's the spike protein that's still there. And what it's done is it's damaged a particular type of immune cell in the periphery, the what's called the non-classical monocyte. So it's a white cell that has two things that happened to it. The spike protein has both turned it into a zombie cell, meaning that cells normally have a lifespan. They live for 5 days, they die, they move, and things move on. So if that were the case, these monocytes after 5 days should be done and we shouldn't have any more problems with them. It's not the case. So he argues that there is persistence of the monocytes because their normal cycle of death has been just completely disrupted by the spike protein. And that these monocytes are now spewing out all of these inflammatory factors, specifically the cytokine patterns that he's identified. Now, so what we aim to do is we aim at the non-classical monocyte in order to shut that down, in order to be able to get rid of the symptoms and the problem. Simple enough. Would that it were so. It does work in some people without question. Now, I want to say also that we've done research with Bruce's group where we fed a bunch of our patients in. So this is in not just because we treat chronic illness, right? We treat chronic fatigue. We treat post-treatment Lyme syndrome. All of these, this mishmash of things, which we regard as neuroinflammatory diseases. And we have found that when we look at their cytokine patterns, there are different cytokine patterns that seem to fall out for people who have ME/CSF, for people who have post-treatment Lyme syndrome, for post-treatment who have post-vaccination syndrome. So different cytokine patterns would suggest different cell lines that have been damaged. And this is early research, and it's not published yet, but it's giving us a hint that there are clearly distinct cytokine patterns, and cytokines might be good markers for us. So that's one piece of what we're looking at. In ME/CSF, one of the things we focused on is reactivation of the herpes viruses, specifically Epstein-Barr. Epstein-Barr, we know it lives in the system. How do we know it lives in the system? Because you get, not Epstein-Barr specifically, but the herpes viruses as a family, you get chickenpox when you're little. And then you get shingles when you're older. The only thing shingles is a chickenpox virus that was living in the dorsal root ganglion of the nerve and crawls out under the right circumstances and then erupts on your skin, causing pain and nerve damage. So we know that viruses can persist in the body in a quiescent stage and then get reactivated at times, and that may be setting off the immune system. So with ME/CSF, we look at specifically Epstein-Barr, and indeed we see what we believe is reactivation of Epstein-Barr in a number of these patients. It is still a challenge as to how you diagnose reactivation of Epstein-Barr and what you look for, and there's arguments to that. We look specifically for reactivation of the IgG early antigen, specifically that one, because there are several others. And we believe that that suggests that there's a reactivation in the system. There are others who say you need PCR testing to prove that the bug is active, but it gets into very technical arguments. And unfortunately, the patients get lost in them because there's a point at which you go, let's see if we treat this if you get better. So, and CMV can do it, and toxoplasmosis can do it. Influenza could have set off the problem. So there's a lot of different bugs that can be the problem. And there's also the possibility that you missed the diagnosis altogether, that the patient had lied. And we certainly see a large number. We're in the Northeast. We certainly see a large number of our patients where there was a failure to diagnose Lyme disease in these patients because the wrong test was done. And Lyme can be a challenging bug to diagnose. So you've got to start trying to understand if you can identify the bug that's active, is it replicating, and then kill it. You got to go kill it. If you've got active Lyme in your system, treating the symptoms and treating neuroinflammation without treating, and in fact, we know very bad treating, suppressing the immune system in a case where you've got an active Lyme infection, very bad idea. So you need to make sure that in fact, that Lyme or other tick-borne diseases such as Bartonella or Ehrlichia anaplasma, those things you have to look for. So you've got to be very thorough in looking for what's going on and see if you've got active bug. And whether or not, or if you can't prove that, then the suggestion is you have inactive bug sitting there still aggravating the system. Strep can persist in the tonsils for God knows how long, and can be an ongoing problem with people having what we call these Pan's Panda symptoms, except the problem I have with Pan's Pandas is the P, which is pediatric. I see these same problems occurring in my adults.
That's gave people a good introduction to this conundrum that hopefully that's again one of the gifts of COVID is and long COVID is that there's more and more work being done to help define is it just a particle or are there actually places in the body where the virus can hide in a fairly dormant state, which is different. Because I said, for the herpes viruses, they all agree that this is possible, reactivation.
Right. But
for the RNA viruses, it will be, that's been the big question. Is there a place? I remember Dr. Chia, who's worked with chronic fatigue for 20-something years, really feels that does happen in a subset of patients. And I think I think what everybody has to remember, the point that I always want to emphasize is that our patients with chronic inflammatory diseases, whatever flavor they are individuals and it's an individual presentation. And I know that's something that you are just from how you describe your work, very much a believer in. And unfortunately, medicine wants everybody to be kind of the same. And you're only, and I've said this before, we're really much alike when we near death. If you've got something that's going to kill you, we can treat you all alike and we're going to do great. But when you have something that makes you not feel well, it really is about you. And then the dance about what is needed is going to depend on the individual. So anyway, I just want to recommend people, your book lays out a lot of straightforward ways of understanding this. And also, you've been very generous with laying out a lot of first steps of working through, and I think that's so important because one of the complaints, and it's true, that, seeing doctors who work like you and I work, it's expensive. But the beauty of your book is you lay out a lot of the first steps that people can do themselves. And, they'll see how far they get because that, the last thing I want to do is someone to spend the resources to see me when what they needed to do was change their diet. Take care of that before.
Yes. And what I did in the book was there's a ton of references. Several hundred references that I put in the book. Why? Because I want your doctor to know that there's research behind all of this stuff. We didn't just make it up. And so they can get comfortable with the fact that there is research backing this up and that you should be treated appropriately. There's only a couple of us running around, Eric. This is the problem, who do work the way we do. And we need to get this information in as many people's hands as possible because there's millions of people. Indeed, the numbers look 20 million.
I still haven't gotten my head around the numbers. Smarter people than me keep telling me that, you know, one of the reasons there's nobody, that a lot of jobs are lacking, is because there's so many people who have left the workforce because of this long haul COVID. And that's frightening, you know, just to think, and because it's not going away. I mean, that is the thing that, you know, maybe we have, we can go on about how the disease seems to have modified. We're not seeing, at least I'm not finding, my patients aren't going as much into that second week, really severe inflammatory state like they did in Delta, you know, in the beginning, thank God, you know, we're not seeing, but still enough people are winding up in the hospital that it's not over.
And this is not a benign bug.
No,
by any stretch of the imagination.
No, this spike protein does things that we're not used to.
No, you're absolutely correct. Yeah. It's called a novel coronavirus because our bodies have never seen it before.
Yeah.
And it's not quite sure how to respond to it. The end result of which is we're seeing this long haul stuff in millions of people.
Yeah.
So it's a very serious disease. We need to take it seriously. You need to do what you can to stay safe and not get the disease to begin with. And then you need to make sure you're taking appropriate steps if you do get sick to recover as much as possible.
On that note, I just want to thank you again. It's been a pleasure, and look forward to continuing to hear what you're doing and support your work.